Welcome to the Good Grief Conversation. I'm your host, Janet Jones, and you're listening to UK Health Radio. This programme brings you honest, gritty, emotional and inspiring conversation around a subject that affects all of us, yet is still very much taboo. So join me now for this inspiring Good Grief Conversation. Today's guest is very different. Today's guest is a murderer. Now, that is his description. He's actually had a life of constant situations that resulted in grief, which eventually led to post-traumatic stress disorder. His strategy for dealing with it was addiction to drugs and alcohol. Now, when he reached the end of this situation where he questioned if he could continue to live like this, he found himself in a place that gave him the wake-up call that he needed and an opportunity to change his life that would lead to him becoming an international motivational speaker, a world-renowned authority on spiritual psychology and of leadership. Now, he is an incredible guy. He has thousands and thousands of followers on social media, and he can pack an audience and inspire and motivate, and he's just absolutely amazing. But it was a long journey for him getting there. In fact, it was so long that we're going to do this conversation in two parts because we didn't have enough time in order to dive right into his awakening and his turnaround. So you'll find more of that in part two, but he has an incredible story that is inspiring and it is powerful. Now, like all of my guests, there will be a gift from Alan in the podcast extras. And if you would like to receive Alan's gift, which there will be more information about that at the end of the program, but if you would like to receive Alan's gift and the gifts of all my other guests, then you need to sign up to podcast extras. Just go to www.thegoodgriefconversation.com and you'll be able to sign up there. It's a big yellow button. Sign up for the podcast extras. Now, when you get there, you will notice that there are three options. And the first option is that this is absolutely free because the most important thing is that people listen to this conversation and benefit from the gifts from my guests. The next opportunity that you have is to support the work that we're doing at the Good Grief Conversation. And you can do that for either the price of a paperback, or if you feel like supporting us a little bit more, then the price of a hardback. We will absolutely appreciate any method that you choose. We're here to serve you. We're here to bring this conversation to you and let it reach you in whatever way it is meant to reach you. So, tighten up your seatbelt because this is going to be one very bumpy ride to Alan's awakening. Prepare yourself. It's an amazing conversation and he is an amazing guy. This is Alan Kleinhans. Alan, thank you for joining me this beautiful sunny afternoon. So I appreciate you giving your time. We're going to be talking about a different kind of grief today, and we're going to talk about the grief that you went through with your life experience, really, and how it led to PTSD, and finally, your soul awakening. And I shared with you when we were offline a moment there that I was having quite a sad day today. And so hopefully by the end of this conversation, I will feel a little bit more energized and alive.
So why don't you just maybe introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about that story and your life journey.
All right. Thank you, Janet. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for having me on the show. It's lovely to be reconnected with you, as I said before, you know, after so long of being on different journeys. And, you know, I was obviously sad to hear about your recent experience. And, you know, so thanks again for inviting me onto the show. I think it's a very important subject, grief. I think many people are not taught to grieve, and many people actually feel very ashamed about grieving, really. I think that's a good word. And
yeah, I think you're right, actually. Almost like it's a weakness.
Exactly.
And I think that's how I felt today. I have plenty of tools in my box, as you know. I tried all of them.
Yeah.
There was nothing I could do with it. And eventually I just decided to sit with it and to stop trying to be brave, to stop trying to think, oh, how someone else, you know, would be doing it, and am I doing it wrong?
And you're right. You're so right. All of that comes into it, especially, you know, we achievers, you know, you and I are both achievers, you know, it's about making things happen. It's about serving other people. And, you know, that brings its own, you know, burden of responsibility. And so what that means is that, you know, unconsciously we feel like, well, you know, I really can't show any weakness. I can't show any vulnerability. And so we put grief on the back burner. But it's such an important thing to do. And, you know, I had my own experience, you know, as you know, and I'm going to share some of that. And I didn't allow myself to grieve, you know, all of my life until I got to a particular point in time, which was I was 32 years of age. And that's the first time I began to grieve for my loss. And loss comes in all kinds of forms. But really, loss is what creates suffering for human beings. You know, whether it's you've lost money, an opportunity, a relationship, a person, and there's varying different circumstances that you can lose a person. Like in your case, you know, you're losing a son. Having to bury your own child is definitely the most difficult thing for a parent to have to do. So, you know, I had my own experience of loss, and, you know, and for a long time, I didn't allow myself to grieve. And it was undermining my ability to show up, you know, as a powerful human being. And it's the same for all people who are ashamed to grieve or feel like it's the wrong thing to do, or really they should just put on a stiff upper lip, as we say in the UK. And then when we encounter somebody who wears their heart on their sleeve, it's refreshing in many ways, but at the same time, it's also unnerving. It makes people feel uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable.
So yeah, I'm happy to share about that. And, you know, for anybody who's listening, you know, I'm South African. Obviously, you can hear that. I've been living in England on and off for 30 years. I've lived in America. I've lived in Russia. I've lived in Austria. I've lived in South Africa during that time too for 7 years, and then came back to England. I'm 53 years young now. And at 32 years of age, I got to a point where I realized that I needed to make a significant shift in my life. I was suffering. I was in this tremendous amount of pain. My mind was so erratic and so tormented that I had physical pain in my body. I was ill. I was abusing myself emotionally and spiritually and mentally, physically. I was addicted to drugs at that point. I'd been addicted for about 15 years, including alcohol, cocaine, ecstasy, marijuana, cigarettes. On top of that, I was toxic in the way I showed up. You know, I was very angry, very volatile, very confrontational. It took, you know, the smallest thing to set me off, you know, because I was, you know, I was just so near the surface of just erupting all the time. And, you know, sometimes when somebody's like that, all it takes is a feather to set them off. Luckily.
And that's because you were putting everything under the carpet, presumably.
Absolutely. I'd been sweeping stuff under the carpet for years, you know, years and years and years. You know, luckily I was surrounded by people who knew me as a kid. They knew me before I went into the military, which had a significant impact on my life. It was a turning point for me, a major turning point. But they knew me before then. They've known me after then. They've known me through the best phases of my life and the worst phases. They loved me through that, and they still love me today. We're still great friends. You know, these are people that I grew up with, and I count some of these beautiful people as lifelong friends, actually. You know, people that I've known since I was 7 years old, 8 years old, 10 years old. And although we live in different countries, we're still very tight, and we're all business owners now, and family members, and your fathers, mothers, etc. But, you know, growing up in South Africa, it was a very, very tough time for me. I was born in 66. I was born into racist, apartheid South Africa at its height, extremely racist, extremely violent. I grew up right next door to a police station. The first 6 years of my life, 1966 to 72, I was right next door to Point Road Police Station, ground floor of a 3-block building. There was a courtyard outside the back door, and I used to play in that courtyard after I came home from creche every day. My nanny would pick me up. My parents were both working full time. She would pick me up and bring me back. I'd play in the courtyard until my parents came home from work. My mother would come home first. My father would usually arrive home about an hour after her. And that was just my life, you know, that first 6 years. And I remember playing in that courtyard. I remember walking home from creche. I remember being at creche and the fun I had there. It's snippets of that. But what I remember, you know, very, very clearly, and the impact it had on me. And obviously, I've done a lot of work on this now. And I'm somebody, you know me, I'm somebody who speaks all around the world, and I've coached, and I've been doing this 20 years. I've been teaching, coaching, and training people for 20 years. But, you know, looking back, I can see what a significant impact that it had on my psychology living next door to that police station. Well, one of the earliest memories I have is around 4 years of age. When I became curious about what was happening in the police yard next door, there was a noise. There was a man screaming. There was a lot of commotion. I was curious. I managed to climb onto some bins, climb onto a wall, and found a little gap in the wall that I could see into the police yard, not next door. I couldn't see a lot, but I could see enough to traumatize a young child. It was something that nobody should ever have to witness, even as an adult. And I remember instantly I felt unsafe. Prior to that moment, you know, generally as a kid, I would have probably looked back and say I felt safe. But at that moment, I felt unsafe because, you know, I saw the policemen in the yard next door. I used to watch them drive, you know, driving their vehicles out of the police yard. You know, they lived right next door. When I was walking, they were around the corner, but, you know, I saw them a lot. And I used to think, oh, wow, you know, they looked amazing in their uniform, you know, with their caps, their uniform, you know, their guns, you know. And any young boy, you know, looks up at a soldier, a policeman, an astronaut, you know, anyone in uniform, a young boy says, wow, that's amazing. But at that moment, I remember feeling unsafe. I couldn't understand why. I was only 4 years of age. I couldn't process it intellectually or through the part of the brain that, you know, creates reason or logic. And then, you know, I had an experience with my father around the age of 5 where I also felt very, very unsafe because I suddenly had the understanding. I mean, looking back at the age of 26, I remember I was in a workshop and I looked back and to one of the earliest memories that I have of my parents. And I remember this memory of my dad. It just kind of came to my consciousness. I thought, wow, gosh, I didn't even know that happened. Well, it obviously happened, but I couldn't remember it until that moment at 26, looking back. And I remember 5 years of age, I had something with my dad where prior to that moment, I would have said that I felt loved and safe in my father's company. And then something happened, you know, he came home from work the way I remember it in this vision. He came home from work. He, the usual time, I was hanging on his trouser leg, you know, pick me up, dad, like a child usually does. So he used to pick me up and throw me in the air. That was a fantastic pastime that I even done with my son when my son was that age. But at that time, at that particular time, he must have had a tough day, stressful day. And when I asked him to pick me up, he looked down and he shouted at me and he said, "Not now, son, I'm busy," but with a very loud voice and a look on his face that at that moment I thought, wow, I froze, you know, I literally stopped breathing. And I remember what happened after that. I remember specifically, I ran into my bedroom and I started crying on the bed. I was bursting into tears. And I remember thinking, what did I do wrong? And I asked myself the question, what did I do wrong? I must have done something wrong because my dad usually picks me up in the air, throws me in the air. It's amazing. This is no different to any other time, right? When I've asked him to do it. But this time, I had that reaction. I couldn't understand it being 5 years of age.
Are you an only child as well?
I'm an only child, yeah. And so parents always working every weekend at the golf club. You know, so I was always going with him to the club every week, all week, Monday to Friday with my nanny all day when I wasn't at creche. And so I remember thinking, when I remember that experience in this workshop that I was doing about my first memory with my parents, and I remember thinking, wow, I forgot that happened. And I remember thinking, gosh, I must have felt so unsafe in that moment because I was thinking, what did I do wrong? It felt like my dad had ripped my heart out of my chest. And that's what it feels like for a child. We don't understand that sometimes as a parent. We don't understand the effect of our words, the effect of our actions. And all of us experience trauma, varying levels of trauma, varying degrees of trauma. It could be very subtle trauma. It could be very, very intense. But we all experience it.
Yeah. You know, as you were growing up, how did that incident influence you?
Well, I felt unsafe. I started to feel more and more unsafe. When I entered school very shortly after that, in South Africa, I started school at 5. It's very common for children to start school at 5 years of age. And I entered the classroom environment. And then again, you know, I had incidences with other boys in the classroom. I was bullied a lot. I was teased a lot by bigger boys. I was got an unusual nose. Most people in the standards in terms of the facial description or the facial structure. And so I was called funny names. And so I remember, again, I was just feeling unsafe. And I wanted to hide, you know, and there was nowhere to go because, you know, I was in this environment with old ball boys, you know, private school, very expensive Catholic school. You know, I was already going to Sunday school from the age of 4. What I was learning there made me feel unsafe. I just felt unsafe, you know, as a kid. And then as I was growing up and I got older and older, I was always just like, how can I disappear? You know, I don't like being here. Wherever I was, I didn't feel safe and I wanted to go somewhere else. But wherever I went, I still felt unsafe there. So it was kind of like I couldn't get it always in my head about, oh, they're looking at me. I wonder what they're saying about me, you know, and that kind of thing. And then the bullying and the teasing continued out. Then I changed schools at the age of 14, 13, right? I was about to turn 14. I remember I was kept back that year. So I didn't graduate to the next class. But when I went to the new school, no one knew that. I kept it to myself. I felt a tremendous amount of shame about that. And I hope nobody finds out that I'm doing this year again. And at the new school, that teasing and bullying continued, you know, and it was more severe because it was boarding school. There was initiation process. It was very intense in terms of hierarchy in the dormitories. There was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. I became a skivvy. for one of the matric boys, which is the final year. They can pick, you know, somebody in the standard six, which is what I was in at the age of 14. They could pick somebody. And as a new boy, I was in a line of boys as a newbie at the school. And I was chosen to skivvy from a guy called Paul. Lovely guy, actually. He turned out to be a lovely guy. And he was really, really cool, actually. He wasn't like most of the other matrics who were quite obnoxious and quite just bullies, right? Really bullies, really.
Well, I was going to say, Alan, what's a skivvy? Because over here, you wouldn't really want to be a skivvy, yeah?
A skivvy was... So he played first team rugby, first team cricket, and he was a prefect. He was captain of a house. And so I was his skivvy, and that meant I cleaned his rugby boots, I cleaned his school shoes, I brought him coffee in bed in the morning, I made his bed, I cleaned his room. I was his skivvy, you know? And on one hand, I liked it because it was kind of like I had a bit of protection because he took a liking to me. On the other hand, you know, I felt humiliated really, you know, because I was like, because the boys who weren't chosen as skivvies were, you know, they looked at the boys who were skivvies and they laughed at them. But it was only later on I saw the benefit of being a skivvy. Actually, it was a benefit, actually. It was tough being at that school. I had to make friends and, you know, I felt very insecure. Lack of confidence, felt very unsafe. You know, I also lacked significance in terms of the relationship with my parents because I thought my parents didn't have time for me. As I got older and I became a teenager, I was more rebellious. The more rebellious I became, the more I got into trouble, the more I got into trouble, the more I disappointed my parents. And my father let me know that. And, you know, very soon after I arrived at school, something happened. There was an incident. I was involved with much older boys. Luckily, I was let off because they said I was easily influenced by the older boys. But we were out of the dormitory at night, which was obviously breaking the rules. There was a massive grounds, this boarding school, massive grounds. And we had gone out into the bush over a hill, still on the school grounds, where these older boys had made a fort. And I was gravitated towards, you know, that group of boys because I was desperate for attention, desperate for connection, desperate for being part of something. And also looking for protection, really, because I was getting bullied. And I thought, let me make some friends with older boys. So I did. And what I did is I became funny. I became funny because I thought, if I make people laugh, they'll like me, right? So I became very good at making people laugh. And I remember I bought this joke book and I learned all these jokes. So I always had a joke and I would always have something. That was mine, like, you know, the Landmark Forum. If anyone's done the Landmark Forum, they have this lingo, this language, and that was my winning formula. That was my ace up my sleeve, right? As soon as I felt threatened, you know, or unsafe, I just thought I'd make people laugh, and that would ease the pressure. You know, I would get attention. Then
you sound like Murray.
And that's exactly what happened. But we got caught bunking out. It's what it was called. You're out of bed, you know, after lights out, etc. And we got caught, and they got hauled into the office, and everyone got six of the best, and about four of these boys got expelled. And luckily, they didn't expel me, but my father came up to the office to talk to the principal. And I remember waiting for my father outside the principal's office, sitting on a bench, thinking, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I'm in such trouble. I'm in such trouble. My dad is going to hate me. You know, my dad's really going to, he's going to be so upset with me, you know. And he came out and I was expecting him to be, when my dad used to get angry, I knew it, right? And I got the belt many times as a kid. But that time he came out of that office and he didn't say anything. He just walked past me, didn't even look at me. I remember this. It's so crazy. He walked straight past me and his car was parked outside. And this is about like, I don't know, it's about 10 o'clock one morning and everyone's in class. It's just quiet, right? There's no one around. And he came out of the thing, walked straight past me, got in his car and then rolled down the window and looked at me and called me with his finger, beckoned me over with his finger. And I went over to the car and it was like a walk of shame, right? And I got to the car and he said, get in. And I got in the car. He was looking out the window, straight out the windscreen, looking straight ahead of him. And he said, Alan, you disappointed me. And he said, get out my car. And I got out of the car and he drove off. And that was probably one of the most heartbreaking moments of my life, really. I thought, you know, wow, I just disappointed my father. And like, I mean, he wasn't even angry. I thought, oh my gosh, that's the worst, right? You know, being angry with someone is very different to being indifferent or just disconnecting from them, right? Because if you're angry with them, at least you've got their energy, even if it's negative energy. But if they just cut you off, that's the worst, right?
It's the worst, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so I remember watching the car drive down the driveway. I remember thinking, oh my God, I've done it now. You know,
given your experience with your father and your parents and the whole school thing, you know, do you grieve a childhood that you wished you had had?
No. I have zero regrets and I don't grieve anything. No, actually, let me reframe that. Yeah, when I got to that point of 32 years of age, when I had that massive shift.
But before then, it's when that pain of the grief and wishing things were different.
Yeah, but I didn't grieve before then. I just... at that point, I grieved everything. I just allowed myself to grieve all of it. And that's why I cried for 9 months. It was like I was giving birth to a new Alan. The slightest thing would set me off.
So, because I'm really keen to get to the awakening part of your story.
So long story short, I leave school. I'm just about to turn 18. 26th of December is my birthday. I leave school and I'm going straight into the army. I've got an E4 enough. I just made it through school. I wasn't academic. And I get home and I'm going to the military. There's a letter on the desk waiting for me. My father says, there's a letter for you there. I had the stamp on it. It said official. And it said, welcome to the South African Defense Force. We look forward to receiving you on the 6th of January. And you will be going to a place called Upington in the Northern Cape. It's known as 8th South African Infantry Camp. There were eight South African infantry camps at the time. I think there are still. And I was going to number 8 in Upington, Northern Cape, hot as Hades. And that, you know, I went in and I got all this basic training. It was intense. It was really hardcore. I hardly slept. Never slept on my own bed for the first like 9 weeks. Always slept under the bed because the bed was always perfect, like a shoebox. Square on the edges. I used to iron my bed. We had to iron our beds with shaving cream and a shoe brush and make the corner like square. And
did you have to go into the army? So you get called up, do you?
Yes, it was compulsory.
Right, okay.
It was compulsory. It was national conscription. Looking back, I could have said, you know what? I don't want to do this. I'm a pacifist. You can't make me do this. And then they would have locked me up for 2 years. Because the 2-year conscription period, I would have been in a military prison. However, I didn't do that. I didn't think about that. My father went to the army. My uncles, my grandfathers, all the male cousins in my family. We're all military. So anyway, I get there, I do this basic training, and I get trained to use this patrol mortar pipe. And a patrol mortar pipe is a 60mm mortars and an RPG-7 rocket launcher, which is a tube on your shoulder, got a sight with a handle and a trigger, and you line it up and you fire these rocket-propelled grenades into buildings or vehicles. And I was trained to use that, and we had these mock operations, and it was awesome. I really enjoyed dropping mortars into tanks and firing this rocket-propelled grenades at these vehicles, and it was a mock operation, right? So it was great. We're having fun, like firing weapons. It was good fun. I never thought I'd...
Real life computer game, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I never thought I'd ever have to use it in real time. But that's exactly what happened in 1987. You know, my whole battalion was then moved to a different camp. We had basic training all over again. We had now mechanized infantry. Now we were in a 6-wheel vehicle with a 20mm cannon on top, an anti-air gun at the back, twin barrel machine gun, a driver. These vehicles are designed to carry 10 troops, 5 on either side, with either the lieutenant or the corporal in the turret and the gunner. And the driver and the anti-air gun at the back. And you know, in about May of 1987, we came back from Namibia. We'd been on the border there. It was a very, very relaxing time in the sun. Had a great tan. 3 months on the border, nothing happening. And we got back and we were expecting to go home for 2 weeks leave. I was looking forward to going home for 2 weeks. I hadn't been home for ages and I hardly came home during my time in the army. I had very little leave. You actually have a compulsory leave of 7 days in the first year, 14 days in the second year. I think in total of my 2 years, I must have had about 10 days leave. That second year, when we came back and they're expecting these 2 weeks leave. So at 0700 hours the next morning, it was a briefing and they said, listen, there's no leave. And from this moment forward, there's no outside communication, no more letters, no more phone calls, because we are officially being called up. We've officially been called up to go into Angola to be part of what's going on up there. And it's covert operation. So we were immediately sworn to secrecy. We had to sign a document, all of us. And then a chaplain stepped up. I'll never forget, a chaplain stepped up after the major had briefed us. And the chaplain said, let's bow our heads in prayer because it's a stark reality that some of us won't be coming home. And then he prayed for us. And then I started thinking, wow, you know, this is serious. You know, we signed this document. And then about a week later, we got into our 6-wheel vehicles. We got into a convoy and we went up to Angola. And it took us a long time to get up there. And we were miles and miles and miles of convoy, you know, tanks, vehicles, water trucks, food trucks, you know. And then we were in Angola. We got there. And then for 7 months, we were at war. And the very first combat we ever had, you know, it was over in 2 minutes like that. I mean, I remember as we were going through the bush, we encountered 4 Russian tanks. And I was still lying on my bench with my earphones and listening to U2, the Joshua Tree. And it was insane, you know. And next minute, I was just listening to the same cassette tape and I had a Sony Walkman. And next minute, the medic on the other side of my vehicle, he jumped up, white as a sheet. He started putting on his webbing. I took my earphones out and I sat up and I said, what's going on? He said, listen. And then I could hear rifle fire. And then I heard an explosion. And then I heard the lieutenant saying, get ready to step out, screaming at the top of his lungs, get ready to step out. And then he was saying, shoot, shoot, shoot in his radio to the other cars. I was in the lieutenant's car as a motorist with a medic. And in front of us were our 3 cars, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie. And we were right behind them in a T formation, but we were in part of a massive formation, which was 2 miles across, 2 miles deep. And it was tank 20mm cannon, tank 20mm cannon. but we were on the right flank. The logistics were slightly off. We were too far to the left. We ran into these four Russian tanks. We were heavily outgunned. And he was shouting to Andre Tom, my friend from Cape Town, who's no longer with us. He died that day right there. I remember Andre Tom, I could hear the radio. Somebody was saying, permission to shoot. He said, shoot, shoot, shoot. And next minute, this tank, this Russian tank came out of the bush. And I was just jumping out of the door as this happened with all my webbing on. And as it jumped out of the door, a bullet hit the door and ricocheted past my ear. And I heard this deafening sound in my right ear. And I felt the puff of air on my face. And I didn't know what had happened in that moment. It was only in reflection. I thought, my God, you know, that was a bullet. And it could have gone in the vehicle. I would have been dead. But as I jumped out and I saw this tank swiveling its turret around to its right and put a shell in the side of that vehicle with Andre Tom in it and Franz Muhlenbeck, may their souls rest in peace. But they would have been, you know, they disappeared in a puff of smoke. It was over for them in an instant. They wouldn't have felt any pain, thank God. Those troops in those vehicles were already out on the ground and we were like in a dogfight on the ground. And I jumped out and I was about to set up my water pipe and the lieutenant started shouting, get back in, get back in. We're retreating because we were heavily outgunned. And so we pulled back. And then a few minutes later, a medic came running through the bush. He said, who's got O positive blood? I said, me. He said, follow me. I followed him through the bush. All the while we were running through the bush, it was gunfire going off. It was insane. People screaming. There was an explosion in the distance. There was a MiG-27. I remember a MiG-27 fighter jet, Russian fighter jet. And this military force that we were fighting against were Russian funded and Cuban funded. Their military was funded by Russians and they had Russian artillery, Russian guns, Russian jets, Russian weapons. And this MiG-27 Russian fighter jet, I remember it flew and it dropped a bomb and there was a massive explosion in the distance. And then a medic disappeared and I got to the edge of this big ridge, which was a big crater in the ground, which actually had been formed by a MiG-27 bomb. But it was the perfect place to treat the wounded out of the line of fire below ground. And the medic, you know, he reached out, grabbed me, he put a needle in my arm. And I remember watching the blood drain from my arm in slow motion. And I followed the blood as it was going down the tube and into the arm of the soldier lying in front of me on the floor. And I looked at this guy and he had this beard. He was lying on his back. And his face was matted with blood. There was flies all over him. So many flies in Angola. And I remember trying to wave the flies off his face and off his beard and the blood everywhere. And the back of his head was missing. And I remember looking at his face and suddenly realizing that he was actually a friend of mine. He was the anti-air gunner in the other car. He had obviously been out of the turret at the time when he ran into attack and some shrapnel had gone through the front of his head and took the back of his head out. Yeah, unfortunately, he bled out. You know, he just bled out right there. But that was my first combat. And then every other day for 7 months, it was insane. You know, just dropping mortars and firing rockets. That's what I was doing every day.
This had a humongous effect on your life, as it would do.
Absolutely.
And as that came on, then life got very challenging for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess that's where the addictions came in. Was the addictions part of hiding all that and not facing it?
Yeah, when I came home 7 months later, I was traumatized, you know. I had dysentery, had it for about 8 weeks. I was just terrified, you know. And then I came out of that experience. I came home and I just withdrew into the recesses of my mind and was locked up inside there. Didn't talk to anybody. Locked myself in my bedroom. Drank myself to sleep every day for months. I was having nightmares. Had them for about 7 years. Often the same recurring nightmare of me running through the bush, running away from the enemy, carrying a baby. It was amazing. Much later on when I did a lot of healing work, I came to recognize that that was my inner child that I was protecting. 1988, 7 months out of the military, it was July. I bumped into, you know, one of my very good friends, Malcolm. I believe he's an earth angel for me. And he said, where have you been? I said, I've been in the military. He said, me too. He said, what have you been doing in the military? I said, man, I've been all over the place. I was sworn to secrecy. I didn't want to tell him. I was feeling guilty and shameful. I was having these visions all the time, these images that I, you know, just these images in my mind all the time. I didn't want to sleep, so I got wasted. Because when I was sleeping, I was having nightmares. So I became unconscious every day. I was already smoking marijuana from the age of 14 at school because I wanted to fit in. Now I was smoking even more of it. I was smoking cigarettes. I was drinking every day and I started taking LSD and I started having these really bad trips, like really insane trips, like terrifying trips. It was all the stuff in my unconscious would come out while I was tripping. And I bumped into him and he said, hey, man. And he said to me, he said, Alan, I've been on this insane operation in Angola called Operation Modular. I said, I was in the same operation. He said, wow, what are you doing? I said, I was in the front line. He said, man, I was in a helicopter. I was flying into the war zone, landing in the middle of this war zone and taking all these wounded soldiers and body bags and you know, back to military hospitals and then coming back every day. He said, I don't even know how you survived on the front line there. He said, man, it was amazing. It's crazy. It's insane. And he said, come up to my place. And we went up to his flat and we just talked and talked and talked and talked for hours and hours. And he's the one who said to me, he said, you know, he was 21. We're both 21. He was so emotionally mature. I'd never met someone like him at that stage, but we formed a really great friendship, and it started right there in that conversation. And we went on to start our first business together. We were tight. He said to me, he said, Alan, you need to understand what's happening inside your mind. And I said, how do I do that? He said, well, you must read inspirational literature. You must begin to observe what's going on inside your head using the stuff I'm going to give you. And he said, the first thing I want you to do is read this book and make notes about it and really read it and really comprehend what the author's telling you. And he gave me a book, he put it in my hand, I remember, and he had all these quotes on the wall, and it was only a little studio apartment. I looked at the book he put in my hand, I'll never forget, it's been around since 1937, but I looked at the front cover of this book and it said, Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill. And the front cover was a pile of gold bullion. And then I turned it over, read the back flap, and he said, Alan, pay attention when you read that book. I'll never forget this, Janet. This was so powerful, and I've never forgotten this, and I've always told people the same thing. What it did for me by reading the book in this particular way that he suggested, I suddenly realized I had this amazing memory, this amazing recall, this amazing retention. He said, when you read this book, imagine as if the author is sitting opposite you and telling you the most important thing in your life. Pay that much attention to it. And I've always read a book like that. So I took that book and I read it three times, cover to cover. And I came back to his place over time and time again. We started our first business. It was amazing. And he was definitely one of my earth angels. And he's still one of my angels. The only difference is now that he was killed in a car accident several years after that by another irresponsible driver. He's appeared to me many times since then, actually. It's amazing because he's the one who put me on this journey. It was July of 1988. I was 21 years of age. And that's the day I became a student for the first time in my life. And I've been a student ever since. A student of life, a student of psychology, a student of neurology, a student of philosophy, a student of consciousness, a student of spirituality. I studied religion for 6 years after that because I was went to two Catholic schools. I was tormented by the fact that I killed hundreds of people. And now I came out of the military thinking, oh my God, now God won't even love me. My parents don't love me. Now God won't even love me. I already didn't love myself already. I already had a terrible self-concept. And so I studied everything. I became a student. And I've been 32 years later, I'm still studying. I love studying. I love human potential. I love consciousness. I love life. I love, you know, the fact that we get to live this life and learn every single day about what it takes for us to show up as powerful human beings. And I've been through ups and downs during that time. It hasn't been easy. I've been bankrupt twice. I'm divorced. You know, I broke my heart as a result of what I did while I was married. I broke my ex-wife's heart. I broke my children's heart. I broke my parents' heart, her parents'. I've gone through some really tough times. I've slept rough on the street. I was addicted to drugs for 15 years before I eventually gave it up. Well, actually more than that, 18 years, if you consider I started smoking marijuana at 14. And I'm telling you that and anyone who's listening, because you name it, I've experienced it. I've been locked up in three different prisons in three different countries during my lifetime. I've done things that when they happened, I was really ashamed of. But now I have zero regrets. Everything happens for a reason. And I'm so glad. I look back and I say, thank you, God, for my life. And I did that this morning on my meditation. I just thought, wow, every single moment has been valid and important and cannot have not happened, could not have not happened, because that every single moment has brought me to this moment.
Yes, which is always the case for our lives. And it's a challenge when you get into this moment. And, you know, I know a lot of people listening to this program are, you know, struggling and suffering. They've lost something, a person, a relationship, whatever. And this moment sometimes doesn't seem like a nice place to be.
It can definitely seem like the worst place to be, often.
So how do you get from there?
It's always our perception that colors the moment. So it's never the moment itself. It's what we're making it mean. So at 32 years of age, it was now May of 1999. And I was in a place where I just was suicidal, had been suicidal for a long, long time. Luckily, I procrastinated my own suicide. I kept putting it off to the next day. I did that for a long time. I was heavily addicted to cocaine. I was burning a hole in my pocket because I was always spending money on alcohol, clubbing, drugs. Also books. I was still reading. I was still going to workshops. At that point in time, I was actually in the middle of the introduction to the Forum Leaders Program, which is now called the ILP, which is the Landmark Forum. I was training to be a forum leader for South Africa. I'd been through every single program up to that point. And the ILP, or it used to be the IFLP then, is the highest you can go. And then you become a forum leader. You're leading introductions to the forum, which is a 3.5-day weekend about what it means to become a responsible, fully functioning adult. And I was in the middle of that. And I was tormented and hated life, angry, and head full of knowledge, but doing nothing with it. And addicted to cocaine, working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, 84 hours a week for Credit Suisse. First Boston, in a very stressful environment. And I remember I opened the paper one day and I was at my wit's end. I opened the paper one day and I was reading the football scores as I usually do at that time. And I opened the paper and I saw an advert for Tony Robbins. And I remember thinking, wow, this is a sign. Tony's come to the UK in 93 and 96. I knew he came. I wasn't ready. I was too busy burning the candle at both ends and loving it. However, now I was lost. I was broken. I was angry. I was suicidal and I was broke financially and I was broke spiritually. And I just was thinking about how can I end this? How can I end this? How can I end this? And I saw this advert. I thought, this is a sign. And so I found a way to get to that workshop 2 months later in July. And almost to the day, definitely to the month, 12 years previous, 11 years actually, when I started reading Think and Grow Rich, July of 1988. And now it was July of 1999. And I'm in Cardiff, Wales with Tony Robbins and 1,500 people. And I'm having this amazing experience in his flagship program called Unleash the Power Within. And I went there because I was I needed help. And I recognized that he was the best in the business of helping people. I started reading his work in 1990. I was listening to him on cassette tape for 9 years prior to that moment in Cardiff. And I remember on the third day, I got the microphone and I started telling Tony, I said, man, I just love you so much. I appreciate your work so much. I've been listening to you on cassette tape for 9 years. You've saved my life so many times. And I recognize that I've just set something down now for the first time in 12 years. And I'm so grateful to you for this program because I put something down right now that's been tormenting me for 12 years. I've been carrying it with me and I suppressed it. And I didn't realize what an effect it was having on me until this moment. And I said, thank you, thank you, thank you. And he started crying and he came down off the stage and he started walking towards me. And I was right at the back and I climbed out from where I was sitting. I ran down the aisle towards him. I literally ran. And about 3 feet away from him, I took off and I jumped onto him like a monkey, arms, legs, the whole works. And Tony's a 6'8" big man. He caught me and eventually I stood down on the ground. He grabbed my head with his hands. He looked down. I remember looking up at him, 6'8".
And you're quite tall yourself.
He held my head.
You are in comparison to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm just about 6 foot. You know, I like to say I'm 6 foot, but I'm just shy of 6 foot. But he grabbed my head with his big hands and he looked down. Janet, I kid you not, I will never forget this moment. This is the moment that everything shifted for me. And I've had lots of those moments, but this was the moment where I really took a big corner. He looked down. He didn't look into my eyes. He looked into my soul. Literally, that's what it felt like. And it was like he was pouring love into me with his eyes. And he held my head and he said, Alan, everybody deserves a second chance, even you. He said, take the lessons from your experience, let the rest go. And I just opened up in front of the whole audience. I just said, hey, Tony, I was in Angola in 87. I killed hundreds of people. It's been tormenting me and I put it down right now. And I'm so grateful for you and this program. I've been listening to you for 9 years. You've saved my life so many times. I've been so suicidal that I used to put your cassette tape in and say, hey, you know, this too shall pass. And I was hanging on. And I said, I just told the whole audience that I killed all these people. And he looked into my eyes and I remember thinking, gosh, I was 32 years of age and I'd never experienced unconditional love until that moment. And it came from a stranger and it blew me away. And I just told him that I was a murderer. And that's what I felt like. And I felt like I was part of that whole racist thing and I was ashamed of it. And military veterans, the reason they kill themselves is because the reason suicide's so high amongst vets is because they can't handle shame and guilt. They can't handle it and they can't talk about it. And so I shared this and he held my head. He said, hey, make your life magnificent. Take the lesson, let the rest go. Stop beating yourself up. It's time to let love into your heart. And he turned me around and he made me face the audience. And there were 1,500 people on their feet. The love hit me like a truck. I fell against him. It was like I'd been physically punched, right? The love hit me so hard. And I was a person who didn't let love in because I had such a shield around me, such a protective shield. And I fell against him and I dropped to my knees and I sobbed like a baby. And everything I'd suppressed since I was a kid, since I was next to that police station, all the violence I'd seen, you know, all the shame, all the guilt. My best friend committed suicide at 14. His name was also Alan. Another best friend of mine, 17, committed suicide. Another friend of mine, Gareth, his sister is in my meditation group in Australia. Gareth, my brother who was at school with me, was killed by a truck while he was walking on the highway. I've lost so many friends. I lost friends in the army. I lost friends after the army who committed suicide because they could not get past what we had seen and done. My brother-in-law, my sister's husband, swallowed a shotgun and blew his head off. You know, there's so many people in my life that I lost to drug overdoses, to suicide, to car accidents, motorcycle accidents, knife fights. And I just began to grieve in that moment. I began to just release, you know, and it was a physical, spiritual experience. I eventually got up to my feet. I walked back to my seat. I cried. I cried for months. I just kept crying. And I was in the process of this healing process. I'd already done a lot of reading. I had a head full of knowledge, right? I had 11 years of knowledge in my head and I had time to act on it. In September that same year, 1999, this is when it really took to the next level, is that I was introduced to spiritual psychology and everything changed after that. And then I began to really heal my own heart at a very, very deep level.
And this is a long journey, isn't it? This isn't, so you don't just read a book and it's all fine, or listen to a podcast and it's all fine. It's a long journey. It's a life journey. And certainly after you've been through what you've been through.
It's a lifetime. It's a lifetime of journey. You know, what people don't understand about healing is it's messy, and that's why they don't want to do it. And also, it takes a lifetime to heal a broken heart. It takes a lifetime to heal trauma sometimes, because we don't want to get into it. And because when we get into it, it's confrontational. It's unnerving. And also, sometimes we have to address incomplete stuff with other people, and that makes us terrified. So healing is, it's important, it's necessary, it's messy, but it takes commitment, absolute commitment.
And it's a whole lot easier to actually sweep it under the carpet.
It's much easier because then no one has to talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about it.
But it gets you nowhere.
It gets you nowhere. And what it does is it stops you showing up powerfully, because now there's always elephants in the room, always. Another important thing is that the world is full of people who are wounded, wounded little boys, wounded little girls in big men and big women's bodies. And they are bleeding on all the people who didn't cut them. And that's important.
They're bleeding on all the people who didn't cut them. Also, the innocent people who come into their lives, they end up hurting those people. Because unless you heal your wounds, you are going to wound someone else.
If you are wounded and you find yourself in a relationship with someone else, inevitably your wound is going to get in the way of that relationship, and you're going to end up bleeding on someone who never cut you.
That's a really powerful way of looking at that. And that just shows the importance of taking responsibility yourself for your wounds.
You have to take 100% responsibility for your life, for all of your transgressions, for all of your pains, everything. You cannot blame another person. The world is, we're in a blame culture. We've been in a blame culture for years and years and years. It's worse than ever. Look at what's happening with COVID-19. People are pointing fingers at China. Donald Trump wants China to be held responsible for COVID-19. You know, it's a blame culture right now.
It is.
What people don't recognize, the very first interview I did on this coronavirus when we first went into lockdown, and I've been doing interviews every single week. I've been on radio. I've been on podcasts. I've been doing Zoom calls, webinars. You know, I've been meditating live every single day in my group, as you know, with 2,100 people. And I said to this very first interviewer, he said, "What do you think about what's happening right now?" And I said, "This is divine design." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, this is supposed to happen. Otherwise, it wouldn't be happening. Everything happens for the right reason, the right time. This is an opportunity for all of us to look inside ourselves and see where we are incomplete, unhealed, and collectively where we are incomplete, unhealed. Because it's not the virus. It's what we make it mean. It's what it's bringing up inside of us."
And it's the same in all situations, isn't it?
It's the same for everything.
What it brings up is the thing that...
It's what it brings up. Whether that's somebody leaving you and breaking your heart, or you having a car accident, or having a flat tire, or losing your job, breaking a leg. It's always what brings up inside of you that you need to look at.
The other stuff. Alan, we are now just about out of time, but an incredible journey that you've been on. And you've had to really clear some serious things. Very, very few people get away without war wounds in this life. It's almost impossible.
Nobody gets away without it. Pain is part of life.
I do know somebody who's pretty much has done that, and they're in their 80s, but I think they are one of the very few.
No. I disagree. I think
there's probably some, if you dig deep with them, there's probably some smaller wounds.
There's always.
But not so severe.
I got an example for you. I had someone in my recent online workshop, Awaken, just in the middle of May. And he said to me before the workshop, "Alan, what am I going to get from it? Because, you know, let me just tell you, my life is awesome. I had an amazing relationship with my parents. I was very successful at school. I was very good at sport. I was the best. I was always the captain of every team. I got colors for every sport." He said, "My only challenge is I only have impaired vision and I've only got 8% sight." He said, "But I'm okay with that because, you know, I've managed it well, and I've got a team around me and life is amazing." And he said, "One other thing, there's only one other thing, is that I'm single, you know, and I'm grieving the loss of a girlfriend, and I really wish I could get her back, but I'm okay with that." He said, "But what am I going to get?" I said, "Listen, my friend, I don't know what you're going to get from this program, but I know you're going to get something. I know that something is going to come up and you're going to be surprised by it, and it's going to blow your mind. And when you enter that domain," I said to him, "you're going to enter the realm of what you don't know that you don't know." Listen carefully. I'm going to say that again for your listeners. When you enter the realm of what you don't know that you don't know, and you discover what you don't know about what you don't know in your psychology, in your unconscious, in the trapped emotions in your nervous system, you will be shocked what's inside your nervous system. you'll be shocked. And some of the stuff is trapped in the nervous system from the time you were in your mother's womb. Some of it is in there for your very first moments of life as a human being on this earth when you were born.
And it's all connected, isn't it? All the dots join.
We've all got trauma. Every single one of us. It's all connected. So when somebody says, I got away with it. Now, just to give you a wrap up the example, my friend, after day one of the course, he sent me a 9-minute audio message. He said, listen, man, I didn't get much from today. You know what I mean? It was a long day. And he said, I'm not leaving. He said, I'll be there tomorrow, but I just want you to know I haven't got anything yet. So I sent him a message back. I said, listen, don't worry. It's only day one, Marty. I said, tomorrow, everything can change. By the mid-morning of the next day, he sent me a message during the first break. He said, listen, I don't know what you've done to me. He said, but you said something this morning and I haven't stopped crying and I can't stop crying. And he keeps sending me messages. He's in South Africa. He sends me messages every day. He says, man, I don't know what's happened to me, but things are just shifting. He's discovering things about himself he didn't even know were in him, inside his psyche. He can't stop crying. He's having such growth and such transformation that his own family have remarked about it. His friends have said, man, there's something different about you.
And so now you're doing the Awakened Soul. And are you doing that Awakening?
It's called Awaken.
Yes.
Yeah, my group is called the Awakened Soul. But Awaken is the 2-day online workshop that I'm doing currently. It's a 4-day program that I deliver in person, but obviously it's lockdown. So I'm doing it online.
And so people can join you over on Facebook. Are you going to keep doing the meditations or are you doing other things?
I am going to keep doing them once lockdown's over and everything, we get returned back to business. I'm going to keep doing them. I'm just going to shift the time to 6 o'clock in the morning or 6:30 in the morning.
Okay. And so that is what, facebook.com/awakening?
No. And if you go to facebook.com/ The Awakened Soul.
The Awakened Soul.
Awakened as in N-E-D on the end. Awaken and then N-E-D, Awakened Soul.
But we can get that once we find you on Facebook. All those links are there anyway.
Yeah, if people want to follow me, then it's facebook.com/ Alan Kleinhans. You got my name. If they want to follow my page, I've got a business page. It's facebook.com/ Alan Speaks. It's A-L-L-A-N, Alan Speaks.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Alan. It's always a joy speaking to you. I always come out with my head going that little bit deeper.
Thank you, Jennifer, for having me. If I can say one other thing about grief, because I love the show about, you know, you call it the Good Grief Show. Grief is part of life. And you know, what people need to do is need to be more vulnerable, need to be more courageous in how they approach life in terms of allowing themselves to feel. We are feeling beings. If you deny your feelings, you're suppressing a part of yourself. Suppression of the spirit leads to depression. And so depression is always followed by suppression. And in order to become depressed, you have to have been suppressing a part of yourself for a long period of time. So feel whatever you need to feel. Emotions are valid. Every emotion is valid. But we have to learn how to deal with them, and we have to learn how to not direct our anger at people. We have to learn how to use our anger effectively and use our frustration and whatever it is we need to meet. The need that we need to meet under the emotion we're feeling. I cover all of that in the program. But, you know, just simply, if you don't grieve, then you're going to keep a part of yourself trapped and locked in a room. And that means that you're never really going to be able to show up fully and powerfully as you were designed to do. And that means that your wound eventually is going to get the better of you. You're either going to get sick or you're going to bleed on someone else who never cut you. You know, that just happens. And you know, in the great words of a good friend of mine, Jeff Brown, if you don't deal with your stuff will eventually deal with you.
It's very true. Alan, thank you so much. I could talk to you forever. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you.
Janet, thank you for having me.
I told you that would be an interesting conversation, didn't I? Now, Alan is really an amazing guy. And like I said at the beginning, this is now going to be in 2 parts. So you can listen to part 2 next week here on UK Health Radio. And when I speak with Alan, we never really quite know where it's going. And I always think that makes for a much more interesting and kind of fluid conversation. So do join us next week for part 2 of Alan Kleinhans. And I'm sure you will find that incredibly interesting also. So until then, I am your host, Janet Jones, here on UK Health Radio. Now, don't forget, if you would like to support the Good Grief Conversation and keep this very important conversation going, then you can do so by joining the Podcast Extras. The Podcast Extras are where I ask all of my guests to provide a gift for you. And Alan has also provided a gift for you too. Just go over to my website, which is thegoodgriefconversation.com,
and then you just click to join the podcast extras. When you get there, you will notice that you can sign up for free, because this information is really crucial that everybody gets it. But you can support us by the price of a paperback book or the price of a hardback book. It's all appreciated. We, you know, love what we do. We're getting amazing responses here. So do please help us to keep this going. Until next week, I am your host, Janet Jones, here on UK Health Radio. Have a great week.